From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with John Perry Barlow, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Barlow says he originally founded the organization to help civilize cyberspace, to make it more accessible and diverse. But now that he sees government and law enforcement encroaching on cyberspace, he wants to keep civilization out. Barlow is also a former cattle rancher and lyricist for the Grateful Dead. Also, we talk with the director of a fictional film autobiography of the late actress Jean Seberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Perry Barlow, has described the internet as a new social space, global and anti-sovereign, within which anybody anywhere can express to the rest of humanity whatever he or she believes, without fear. In 1990, Barlow co-founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which defends civil liberties in cyberspace. But his background is not in computers. He spent much of his adult life running the Wyoming cattle ranch he inherited from his family. He sold the ranch in 1988. He also wrote songs with Bob Weir for the Grateful Dead and was associated with the band since its early days. Barlow is a popular essayist and lecturer on the new issues of cyberspace. In answer to the new federal legislation banning indecency on the internet, Barlow wrote a Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace. I asked him if he's concerned that his three young children might come across indecent material on the internet.
First of all, you know, in my experience, I don't find that obscenity is any easier to come by on the internet than it is in the physical world. And in fact, you know, it's considerably more in your face in practically every convenience store in America than it is on the internet. You have to go looking for it on the internet, and in fact, it's difficult to find there because most of the sites that might contain some pretty hot stuff are usually too busy to get into. It's kind of like that. That Yogi Berra line, nobody goes there anymore, it got too busy, you know. But to really address the question, I feel like, you know, I've got three young daughters, and this may not be the common way to raise children in America, but I feel like the best way to prepare children for adulthood is not to abstract them from all of those elements of adult life that we would rather didn't exist. There's this strange practice in America of springing adulthood on children when they become adults, having not discussed it with them or dealt with it face to face in many of its tawdrier elements. And frankly, I think if you don't want your kids looking at pornography, the best way to deal with that is to teach them to find it as distasteful as you do.
You object to government regulation of content on the internet. Do you think that there is a place for government intervention on the internet? And do you think that there are any rules or standards that need to be maintained, whether it's the government or another body maintaining them?
Well, what government? I mean, the internet is a global space. It's continuous and seamless. And, you know, do I want our government to try to run it? Do I want the government in Saudi Arabia to try to run it, or the government in France to try to run it? Which government are we talking about? You see, there isn't any jurisdiction that can be easily established unless you can clearly say that this is a social interaction or a commercial interaction that is taking place entirely involving people within one geographical jurisdiction, with all of the hard disks and hardware that's associated with that interaction within that jurisdiction. But most of what goes on in the internet is not like that. And the problem that Congress has is that they are so used to broadcast media where there is an obvious source and an obvious audience that they can't get it into their heads that this thing has got sources all over the planet and audiences that are the same as the sources. They cannot understand a many-to-many medium.
Do you have two visions of the internet, one a utopian vision and the other a dystopian vision?
Well, I have, I'm a Taoist, so I have two visions of everything. But you know, I think this is a very, very large event in the history of humanity. I mean, the coming of the net and the transfer of all of human knowledge into bits is probably the most sweeping technological occurrence since the capture of fire in terms of its long-term capacity to change what it is to be human. So I assume that a lot of things will come as a result of the internet, and saying, is this a good thing or a bad thing, is a little like saying, is the weather a good thing or a bad thing? You know, sometimes it's sunny and beautiful and grows flowers, and sometimes it rips the roof off your house.
So what are some of the good and the bad outcomes that you see from the internet?
Well, I'm sort of a glass half full kind of guy. And, you know, one of my friends told me years ago that I was a pronoid, by which she meant that I thought the universe was a conspiracy on my behalf. So your mileage may vary, but I tend to think that most of what comes of this is pretty good, in the sense that, you know, for the first time we're creating a social space in which anybody, anywhere, can say whatever they feel like saying, and it's going to be very difficult for anybody else to shut them up. And, you know, I think that when you've really got free flow of human thought, I'm a strong believer that truth will out. I mean, truth can support itself in an open market.
So you see the internet as something that, you know, more than any other technological advancement, is going to change what it means to be human. Why not the telephone or television or radio? I mean, why do you think that the internet has this great transformative power?
I would say that the telephone is a continuous part of what I'm talking about. I mean, what I think about, I mean, I look at this as the formation of cyberspace. And cyberspace started forming with the telegraph, which was the first time that you could really converse with another human being over a great distance in real time. And, you know, the first almost face-to-face encounter in cyberspace was when Alexander Graham Bell met somebody named Watson there in 1876. And it's been growing ever since, but we didn't recognize it as being a space until quite recently, because it was an end-to-end conversation, or it was a one-to-many non-conversation, as is the case with broadcast media. And what we had was not what we have now, which is telematic assembly. You could have telematic conversation, but you couldn't have telematic assembly. Now, you really do have a social space and a marketplace. And this is, I mean, I, unless I'm mistaken, I'm the first person to ever start using the term cyberspace to refer to something that already existed. And prior to that, I don't think people were thinking about it as a place or a space or a condition of assembly at all.
John Perry Barlow is my guest. He's co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a civil liberties and cyberspace group. And he's also written a lot of lyrics for the Grateful Dead. He's on the board of directors of The Well. I think it was in the past year that your wife died, and I want to say how sorry I was to hear that.
Well, actually, she wasn't. We weren't married.
You weren't married. Yeah, sorry.
She was my fiance.
Right.
And, yeah, it was a real shock.
You.
I'm still getting over it. It's been about a year and a half, but I'm doing all right.
You have on your homepage a lot of articles and that you've written over the years and lyrics that you've written. You also have a eulogy you wrote for your lover, and it's a very moving piece. I'm wondering, when you posted that on the internet, what kind of response did you get? Did you get a response to it?
Well, I didn't really, you know, I didn't set out to post it on the internet, but this, you know, this was a sudden and devastating event in my life. I mean, she was 2 days short of her 30th birthday, and I put her on a plane in Los Angeles, and she was fine, and she was dead when they took her off of it. And, you know, a vital, healthy, promising young woman. I mean, she was a psychiatrist at the age of 30, you know, full-fledged. This was such a shock to me that that I didn't do that usual secretive thing that Americans do with death. I just had to kind of get it out, and I sent off to my friends, just to the list of my friends, what's still on my homepage about this event. And they ended up sending it to other folks, and it self-proliferated. And I, as a consequence, got probably, I don't know, over a megabyte of electronic mail from people all over the planet who had not talked about death intimately with anybody, because there's such a cultural predisposition to make it secret and obscene at the moment. And it was incredibly encouraging. I mean, I tend not to believe in internet community, but I definitely felt like in some funny way that some large portion of the human race had put its arm around my shoulder at a time when I needed that. And it was, you know, it was one of those things that makes me think that something is going on here that has real depth of soul.
You know, I really like your homepage a lot, because it's filled with information. You have a lot of copies of articles that you've written. There's a bio of you. Your lyrics are there. I mean, you could really, photographs, old and new photographs, you can really get a sense of you as a person and, you know, of your thoughts by looking at it. And I think a dilemma a lot of people have with homepages and stuff is how much should they give away and what should they charge for? And you know what I mean? A lot of, like, homepages on the web are like little promotional sites. And it's very refreshing when you come on, you know, a homepage that's chock full of information.
Well, I mean, you know, in some way, that's a promotional site too. I mean, there's something pretty narcissistic about about putting up a really detailed poster of yourself for the rest of the world to study. You know, there's a lot of deep-seated narcissism on the World Wide Web. But you know, I just, rather than try to explain myself to folks that might want to know every time somebody asked, I just decided that I would put in one place what I could think of that would sort of essentially define me without actually meeting me. And I think the advantage was that I didn't spend very much time at it. I mean, a lot of homepages are sort of labored over, and I doubt that I've spent more than 3 hours max on that one.
Now, on your homepage, you give your address, you give phone numbers, your beeper number. I'm reading this and I'm thinking, he's crazy.
I am crazy. But it's a, you know, it's a social experiment. I mean, I think that you know, in spite of the fact that I'm a privacy advocate and I spend a lot of time trying to help people who want to be private in cyberspace do so, I think that there's basically something not terribly healthy about the current national zest for privacy. I think that you know, it's a reflection of how much we dread our own government. It's a mirror image of secrecy in government. And the more secretive the government becomes, the more obsessed we become with being private ourselves.
This is probably spoken by somebody who hasn't gotten a whole lot of phony phone calls and heavy breathers and
that's true. I mean, but you know, the funny thing is, and this is this
not
is
to mention having your house robbed. Yeah, go ahead.
This is straight hippie mysticism, but I honestly believe that, you know, the greatest safety lies in vulnerability. And, you know, if you put yourself out there so that the only thing between you and the other person is their conscience and some sense of the social contract, you won't be disappointed, and I haven't been. I mean, I'm wide open, and people have not abused this. People are very decent to me, and I don't get weird phone calls. I mean, except from, you know, except from weird folks that I'm sort of interested in hearing from anyway. I don't get much abuse, and I don't get robbed, and I don't get, you know, vandalized, and I don't know. I mean, I think human beings are basically pretty good, and if you treat them accordingly, I mean, if you set out with that assumption, it's astonishing how rewarded you will be by the expectation. At least that's my experience. I, you know, your mileage may differ, as I say.
My guest is John Perry Barlow. He's the co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the culture of cyberspace with John Perry Barlow. You're a co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil liberties and cyberspace group. You say that the mission was to civilize cyberspace. What does that mean?
Well, that was the original idea. I mean, you know, I come from the Wyoming frontier. I mean, really very recently settled part of the North American continent. My great-uncle was the first white man to spend a winter in the upper Green River Basin, and not that long ago. So I, you know, Pinedale, Wyoming is still kind of a frontier settlement, and I was looking for frontiers. So when I first got into the world that was being created inside digital media, I was immediately struck by frontier analogies and metaphors. I mean, that this was an unsettled place, that it was filled with sort of wild, woolly characters that were social misfits and able to tolerate very austere conditions, and that the railroads were coming, you know, and that the settlers were coming. And so when Mitch Kapor and I started EFF, we were looking to make cyberspace safe for the women and children, essentially, in sort of a 19th century manifest destiny kind of way.
I'm not going to point out the sexist nature of that analogy.
Well,
go ahead.
I said it was 19th century now. And you know, frankly, there were damn few women and children in cyberspace when I encountered it.
True,
and that was,
right.
Along with practically everything else besides, you know, smart white guys who can't dance. And, you know, I may be a smart white guy, but I can dance, and I like the company of lots of other kinds of folks. And so I was eager to make it a place where other kinds of folks could be comfortable.
So how do you think the focus of the Electronic Frontier Foundation has changed since 1990 when you co-founded it?
Well, I'd have to say, for one thing, that, you know, just personally, I went from being interested in civilizing cyberspace to keeping civilization out. I mean, as I gradually realized that this was a condition of somewhat more noble savagery than I had ever encountered before, that there was a self-organizing quality to its internal governance that would only be harmed by the imposition of laws of the sort that don't do a very good job regulating the physical world. So where we were originally interested, I think, in trying to establish things like the First Amendment in cyberspace, we're now, I would say, more interested in trying to keep regulation out of cyberspace and to encourage the development of a responsible system of ethical governance within that domain. I mean, this is a very, very interesting undertaking from the standpoint of trying to figure out how people learn about behavior. But I'm of the opinion that there is an inverse relationship between laws and ethics, and the more legalistic a society becomes, the less ethical it is, as America has become a great case in point. And that if you have a condition where laws are difficult to apply for a variety of reasons, then ethics will reemerge. And I think they are. You know, it's astonishing. You've got, really, at this point, tens of millions of people gathered in the same venue, and it's astonishing how little adverse interaction there is.
I believe before you started the Electronic Frontier Foundation, you were visited by the FBI. What did they want to know about cyberspace?
Well, first of all, they didn't know there was any such thing, and at that point, neither did I, or at least I hadn't started talking about it that way. But I got a visit from Special Agent Richard Baxter in the Rock Springs, Wyoming field office back in early 1990, and I knew Agent Baxter from before. I'd had livestock stolen when I was still in the cattle business, and he's a pretty good hand with livestock theft. But in this instance, he was at sea. He was very nervous on the phone, and I hate it when I hear an FBI agent call me up on the phone and not want to talk about why he's coming to visit and be real nervous. That's a terrible sign. But he showed up, and he was investigating something that he referred to as the New Prosthesis League, which was, in fact, something that called itself the New Prometheus League. And that was just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, he had this... It was somebody had taken a little snippet of Apple's source code for the Macintosh ROMs and was shipping it around in a copyright protest, I would say, because of Apple's very proprietary behavior regarding intellectual property. And it posted at various places on the net, and Apple characteristically had freaked out and had decided that somebody was about to reveal the entire Macintosh recipe and that the Taiwanese would be turning them out in no time, or at least that's what they told the FBI. And the FBI didn't really know what to do with this, so they were just sort of roaming around like the brooms in The Sorcerer's Apprentice, sweeping miscellaneously. And Agent Baxter knew through the FBI that I had attended something called the Hackers Conference, which actually had nothing to do with computer crime. It was attended by people like Steve Wozniak, you know, in the old sense of hacker. But the FBI decided that maybe the people who went to the Hackers Conference would know something about this digital terrorist that was going to blow Apple out of the water. And I had to spend 2 hours with Agent Baxter explaining to him what exactly the crime was before I could tell him that I hadn't been the perpetrator and wasn't likely to know the perpetrator. And I realized then, I mean, this was such an Alice in Wonderland experience. I realized that what I was seeing was the first incursion of American federal government into this new place.
It sounds like this has become like a metaphor for you of people who are trying to regulate something that they don't understand.
It was one of those conversion moments where I realized that here you have, you know, clueless, well-armed, insecure people roaming around in a place they don't understand and that scares them. And nothing good can come of this. And now, instead of Richard Baxter, we've got the entire United States Congress coming in and proposing to regulate someplace they've never been using tools they don't happen to have.
John Perry Barlow is co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He writes for Wired magazine. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, building community in cyberspace. We continue our conversation with John Perry Barlow, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He's also written lyrics for the Grateful Dead. And we meet the director of a new fictional film autobiography of the late actress Jean Seberg.
Heartless powers try to tell us what to think. The spirit's sleeping, then the flesh is ink.
Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with John Perry Barlow. He co-founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which defends civil liberties in cyberspace. He also writes for Wired and other magazines about the new culture of cyberspace. You did an online forum a while back with a couple of computer hackers who were kind of famous for breaking into files. And you wrote there that... that you found these kids fractious, vulgar, immature, amoral, insulting, and too damn good at their work, and also criticized them for making you feel like an old fogey.
That was the worst part.
did your encounter with them change your views about computer hackers and what should
my virtual encounter with them, made me think that computer crackers were just exactly as big a menace as the government claimed. I compared them to skateboarders at one point, and this being accurate, that really made them mad. So they downloaded my TRW file. And
is your credit file?
Yeah, my credit file, and claimed that they were going to change it to my permanent lack of credit if I didn't pipe down, which they actually couldn't do. I mean, this is a bunch like desperados on the frontier. This is a bunch that is long on brag and short on action. But so I emailed one of them and I said, look, we've just exceeded the bandwidth of this medium. I would appreciate it if you'd give me a phone call, and I'm not going to insult your intelligence by giving you my phone number, which was listed anyway, but he didn't know that. So just to prove to me that he could get me right away, he calls me up immediately. And as soon as he got on the phone, I realized what I was dealing with. I mean, this was a kid whose voice hadn't changed yet. It was a pencil-neck geek kid with a lot of time on his hands and no adult supervision and smart as hell. And he was basically engaged in the same thing I was engaged in at his age, which was violating the forbidden. I mean, there is something about, young teenage boy that makes him want to violate the forbidden. I mean, they always want to violate the same forbidden, but, failing access to that, they'll break into equipment yards or computer systems. And so that began a much more human conversation, which resulted eventually in my meeting the members of what at that point called itself the Legion of Doom, rather grandiosely, and becoming sort of like their scoutmaster. I think the thing that I learned about this that was the most important aspect was that here were these kids that really had the capacity, technically, to do a great deal of damage and to steal a lot of money and to generally wreak havoc. And nobody was in a condition to stop them. Nobody even knew what they were doing. And yet, none of that was happening. And the reason that none of that was happening was because they had developed an ethical code which was working.
What was their code?
That if you damaged systems, you were beyond the pale, because they felt about damaging a computer system in the same way that a spelunker would feel about another spelunker knocking off stalactites. I mean, going into these computer systems was holy to them, and they did not believe that there should be anybody damaging those systems or leaving a track, for that matter. So, and they were very offended by anybody who wanted to try to go in there and do it for money.
How did you first use a computer when you got it? Did you get it knowing that you'd be using the internet and using it as a way to communicate with people you'd never met?
No, I think I had the usual misconception about what a computer was. I thought it was a better form of whiteout or a bigger adding machine, which is how most people first encounter computers, I think. I mean, most of the computers in the world are still dedicated WordPerfect servers. And, all they are is a fancy kind of typewriter.
And how'd you branch out from there?
Well,
You were living, what, on your cattle farm, right?
I was ranching in Wyoming at that point, and I started to think a lot more about deadheads and community. I mean, I came from this little town in Wyoming that seemed to be languishing in the demise of agriculture, and I was concerned about the end of community in America because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, as somebody who comes from a small town, it's been largely abolished. I mean, most of America is now generica. There is very little of the kind of social interaction that I see common in my little town. And I was wondering what was going to be the repository of community after all those little agricultural towns died off. And I was looking at things like the Deadheads, who seemed to have that kind of, that sense of shared responsibility for one another, you know, the sense of themselves against the collectively adverse. But I couldn't understand how they maintained a sense of continuity given that, you know, they only got together at shows or when the band was on the road. And then somebody told me about The Well, which is a conferencing system, still one of the best little towns in cyberspace.
You're on the board of directors of it now.
Yeah. And this was a system that had been set up by Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth catalog folks. And the Deadheads had gone there, and they were using that as their point of continuity. That was their virtual village green. And so somebody told me about this, and I got a modem and hooked my computer up to a phone line and logged into The Well, and lo, there they were. And there it was. And it seemed, at first flush, it seemed an awful lot like a small town, you know, and still has many of those elements.
There's so many different, seemingly unrelated parts of your life, you know, running a cattle farm that you inherited from...
Ranch, please.
Cattle ranch, sorry, that you inherited from, what, your father and grandfather?
Yeah.
And let's see, you were in local politics, Republican county chair for a while, plus you... in the early 70s, hung around with the Dead a lot. You've written a lot of lyrics.
Oh, no, I mean, I've been hanging around
for years,
with the Dead,
right, okay.
as long as there's been such a thing.
Thank you for correcting that. And, yeah, and you've written a lot of lyrics for them. So let's see, you know, plus all the cyberspace stuff. So let's see if we can reconcile the Republican County Chair with the Grateful Dead connection. That seems like the two really most distant parts of your biography.
Well, but see, first of all, I'm a great believer in paradox. I mean, I think that paradox is the gateway to the divine, and that anytime you can set up some kind of ironic juxtaposition, you can create a pathway in there that will have a lot of energy in it. So I've never been much for trying to be linear about things. And in fact, within my own context, it all made perfect sense. I mean, I was into the Grateful Dead because of community and wanting to and create a sense of community self-determination in that world. And I was into Republican politics in Wyoming for exactly the same reason. You know, first of all, I come from a one-party county where there's a fair amount of ideological range within the Republican Party. But also, you know, the main thing was that the Republican Party there believe strongly in diminished government, and I'm a strong believer in that myself. And I would say that your average Deadhead is not a big fan of big government, given what the government does to Deadheads. So it's, you know, there's a continuity there. There's a perfect continuity there. It just looks paradoxical on the surface.
Now, I know with you in your studio, you have a portable computer, your beeper, and
yep.
cellular phone.
Yep.
Do you ever want to unplug for a while?
Well, lately, yeah. I mean, I'm getting about 300 email messages a day at the moment.
What do you do with all of that?
Well, I answer as many of them as I can and hope for the best with the rest of them and you know, beg the indulgence of those who don't get answers. But, you know, I'm not ready to change that yet because I feel like in some basic way I am connected, really connected to a large part of humanity. And, you know, the invisible extensions of my nervous system are now reaching out there and tangling their synapses with other people's. And I don't know. I mean, I have a kind of a mystical vision that I came down with reading Teilhard de Chardin in college that what we're about here is creating the global organism of mind. And I'm very much a part of that process.
But let me ask you, if you got your...
And happy to be.
If you got your mail, the 300 letters a day through the post office instead of through email, would it be any more or less a mystical experience?
Well, it'd be an incredibly oppressive experience. I mean, that would be horrible.
Why?
I mean, just the physical labor of opening 300 envelopes and, you know, reading their contents and dealing with the debris, it would be an insurmountable task. I mean, I can actually read or at least scan.
Well, say it was answers on an answering machine instead of...
Oh, well, that would be, you know, again, you know, an answering machine. How, in order to get a message on an answering machine, you got to listen to the whole damn message. You know, and a lot of the time... I can get the first three sentences of an email message and know that I, you know, what to do with it.
So, but you're saying it's built for speed, not that it's more mystical.
Well, except for the fact that it feels the way in which that conversation works, it feels like it's synaptic firing in a way that snail mail doesn't. It has an instantaneous quality. I mean, there's a real conversational back and forth that you don't have with regular mail, because there's too much lag time in it. I mean, I do this in part because I've become extremely mobile. I mean, the great irony was that I thought after I left the cattle business that I would get into this electronic stuff and it would make it possible for me to stay, leave my body in Pinedale, Wyoming, and let my mind roam the planet and make a living. And the interesting thing that happened was that I leave my mind at barlow@eff.org and let my body roam the planet. Because I'm very interested in actually making direct experiential contact with the things that I encounter in cyberspace.
Well, I regret we're out of time. I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's been a delight.
John Perry Barlow is the co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He writes for Wired and other magazines. Coming up, a new film from the director of the film essay, Rock Hudson's Home Movies. This is Fresh Air. Do Rock Hudson's romantic comedies take on a new meaning when you know that he was gay? Screenwriter and director Mark Rappaport explored that question in his 1992 film essay, Rock Hudson's Home Movies. Rappaport's new film examines the life of the actress Jean Seberg. Seberg made her film debut as a teenager, starring in Otto Preminger's St. Joan. It made her famous, but she was so miscast it nearly ruined her career. Nonetheless, she achieved cult status soon after when she played the young American in Jean-Luc Godard's landmark 1959 film Breathless. Later in her life, after she became involved with the Black Panthers, the FBI tried to ruin her career. She committed suicide in 1979 at the age of 40. The new film, called From the Journals of Jean Seberg, uses Seberg's life as the springboard to talk about the language of filmmaking. It interweaves clips from her films with excerpts of fictional journals written by the director Mark Rappaport. The journals are read by Mary Beth Hurt, who plays the part of Seberg. Here's the opening of the film.
If you were around in 1957, you know who I am. Otto Preminger had a talent search for someone to play Joan of Arc in his screen adaptation of George Bernard Shaw's St. Joan. It was the most well-publicized hunt for a new face since Vivian Leigh was chosen to play Scarlett O'Hara. 18,000 girls sent in their photos, and 3,000 were granted personal auditions with Mr. Preminger. The unique thing about this production is they were looking for someone who actually was Joan's age. I was 17. And I got the part. People magazine didn't exist then, but if it had, I would have been on the cover. Entertainment Tonight didn't exist then, but if it had, you would have seen me there too. But for the 50s, I had as much exposure as anyone could get. Even before the cameras started rolling, everyone knew who I was. I was on the Ed Sullivan Show. I was in Life magazine. No cover. I was on the Mike Wallace Show. That was the good news. The bad news was we made the movie.
Your film is part of a genre that I think doesn't quite exist yet outside of your film.
It's like a new genre.
It's like a new genre.
A genre builder.
Yeah, that's good. Why don't you describe the film? I mean, what kind of film essay this is?
Well, I have taken to describing it as a fictional autobiography. It's a life of an actor who is no longer with us, and as if he or she is still around, he or she is discussing his life, his career, through the movies that he or she made. The reason I say he or she is because, in addition to From the Journals of Gene Seberg, I've also made a film a couple of years ago called Rock Hudson's Home Movies. And in a sense, they're analyzing from a modern perspective their life and their career and their films. And it becomes not exactly, it's a kind of gossipy thing, but it's also kind of cultural criticism. I mean, in a sense, it's revisionist film history, but not quite as boring as that might sound.
Now, you have cast an actress, Mary Beth Hurt, as Jean Seberg, and Mary Beth Hurt plays Jean Seberg reciting her journals, but of course, these aren't really Seberg's journals. They're the journals you wrote and gave the actress Mary Beth Hurt to read.
Right, there are no journals.
Yeah, so do you have anything that you've based your perceptions on besides your own perceptions? In other words, was there any documentation of how Jean Seberg actually felt about her movies or, you know, felt about her performance in St. Joan?
No. That's a short answer. To my knowledge, there are no records. I mean, there are a couple of interviews, and a couple of lines in the film do come directly from her when she said, Otto Preminger was the most charming dinner guest in the world and the most sadistic director in the world. But basically, it's all supposition, inference, my own conclusions. I would have to stress that it is a fictional persona of Jean Seberg that I'm presenting. I do not call this film a documentary in standard documentary terms, but others have called it a documentary, so who am I to argue with them?
You cast Mary Beth Hurt in the Jean Seberg role. Why did you choose her for it?
That is an interesting story. Do you have a couple of hours? I'm not supposed to eat sugar. This is the personal part of the show. I'm not supposed to eat sugar. And after I finished the final version of the script, but I love it. I ate a box of cookies, and it just kind of knocked me out. And I took a nap. And as I got up from the nap, I said, "Mary Beth Hurt," who I'd never thought of her before in relation to this film. Although I thought of her as a very excellent actress. And I looked her up in a film reference book, and it says Mary Beth Hurt, born in Marshalltown, Iowa, which is the same city that Jean Seberg was born in. And I said, this is amazing. You know, karmic cookies. So I called up her agent, and indeed she was interested because she, coming from Marshalltown, Iowa, she knew all about Jean Seberg. And furthermore, she grew up around the corner from the Seberg family. And there are a lot of connections between Mary Beth Hurt's family and the Seberg family. So it really was a very strange connection. It's one of those things that you can't will that kind of association into being. I was just very lucky. It's very, very strange.
My guest is Mark Rappaport. He wrote and directed the new film From the Journals of Jean Seberg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mark Rappaport, he wrote and directed the new film From the Journals of Jean Seberg. You know, your film is not just an essay about Gene Seberg. It's about film and filmmaking. And one of my favorite parts of the film is when you compare close-ups, the close-ups of Gene Seberg with the close-ups of Clint Eastwood, who was her co-star in Paint Your Wagon. What are the different things you see when comparing their close-ups?
Well, in the film, I suggest that Jean Seberg is, in a sense, the first modern movie actress because the camera looks at her and looks at her and looks at her, and she breaks that fourth wall, which you're not supposed to do in movies. She looks back at the camera, and when you look at the camera, it looks as if you're looking directly into the eyes of every spectator in the audience. And she was the first person who was asked to do that and the first person who did that, to my knowledge. And the camera spends a lot of time looking at her and wondering what she's thinking. The camera spends a lot of time looking at Clint Eastwood as well, especially in the spaghetti westerns that he made with Sergio Leone. But his close-ups, even though he really fills the frame, they are not quiet and contemplative. We're not trying to uncover a mystery when we look at Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood is kind of waiting and watching for the next moment of action, for somebody to be reaching for their gun, for the killer to appear above the edge of the roof. But we spend a lot of time looking at Clint Eastwood. But again, his face, like Gene Seberg's, is a blank, and we don't know what he's thinking. But we're not really that interested in what he's thinking. We're more interested in what he's going to do.
Now, I think of your work as film criticism in action, movies that function both as movies and as film criticism. Did you ever think of becoming a film critic?
God, no. Well, let's say cultural critic as well as film criticism.
Fine. I'll accept that.
Because I'm not just dealing with the movies. I think from the journals of Gene Seberg and Rock Hudson's Home Movies are very, for me, they're interesting ways of reexamining social, political, sexual, cultural values of the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You had said that you didn't really know who Gene Seberg was, and Gene Seberg herself doesn't interest you all that much, but it becomes like
Let me clarify what I said, that I'd only seen one of her films and wasn't really like, you know, she wasn't very, you know, particularly important to me.
Right. But
does that sound a little better?
it still leads into what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Gene Seberg becomes a vehicle whereby I can examine social and cultural values and mores of the 50s and 60s and the 70s as well. I think if it were just like a straight, you know, ordinary documentary, it would not be that. It would not be that interesting, certainly not for me to work on. And this becomes a way to discuss the times. In a sense, the format, the autobiography, becomes a spine around which I can examine various different issues and ideas of the times.
So why did you think Jean Seberg would lend herself to this type of cultural examination?
Well, I'm sad to say that part of it is because she was this victim. She actually was a political casualty of the political and emotional casualty of the 60s and 70s. I think she lends herself to it because her death was really precipitated by the all-out campaign by the FBI to destroy her.
Did the fact that she committed suicide at age 40 also make her, in a way, a more logical candidate for you because she died before she was completed?
Yeah.
And so you can project more onto her.
Yeah. Well, this is certainly true. One wouldn't even attempt something like this with Jane Fonda because the story's not over.
Right.
Also, there is something tragic about Jean Seberg. I don't like the word tragic. It's not a Shakespearean play. But there is something awful about a life that's not fulfilled and that ends short and that ends in a way that it should never have ended, you know.
Your Rock Hudson film and Gene Seberg film are part of this new genre that you've created of film cultural criticism that's very entertaining, not dry at all, but filled with ideas. How did you come up with this concept for a new kind of film?
Well, various projects of mine had collapsed, and actually four projects had collapsed within a period of 3 months, and I said, oh, God, I've just got to keep working. And I had this idea to, well, this is an easy way to do it. You know, just sit at home with your VCR and you can do it. And that's kind of how Rock Hudson's Home Movies and finally, most recently, Gene Seber, from the journals of Gene Seber came into being. I felt I had to do projects that were cheap, that could be done relatively cheaply, and that I could do by myself with complete control. And that would be it. I didn't need, you know, $200,000, $1 million to do them. And somebody else saying, yes, we'll give you the money, or no, we won't give you the money. I just winged it.
Well, you've been making movies for a long time. Mm-hmm. You're one of the independents who hasn't signed up with the major studios. Have they not knocked on your door, or have you said no?
I guess my films say, please don't knock on my door. I don't know. They haven't knocked on my door. I've not said no. I've not had a chance to say yes or no, but I think my films pretty much say no trespassers.
Right. I'm not what you're looking for.
I'm not what you're looking for. It ain't me, babe.
Have you asked yourself what you think Jean Seberg would say about your film if she saw it, and whether she'd say, I never thought anything of this, of the sort?
I haven't asked myself, but people come over and tell me, they tell me, how could you do that to her? But the most gratifying things I've heard are two people who I didn't know prior to this, who told me that they knew her quite well and felt that it really captured something about her and something about her spirit. And they were immensely gratified to see the movie. And I found that very, very satisfying to hear.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was great fun.
Mark Rappaport wrote and directed the new film from the journals of Gene Seberg. It opens Friday in New York and will open in other cities in the weeks to come. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf, research assistants from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with saxophonist Barney Weilen playing Cole Porter's Don't Fence Me In.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of We're Right, They're Wrong, a handbook for spirited progressives by James Carville. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.